Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
Christy Gutkowski was with us last week. Her piece about A.J. Friend, that little boy who was killed and buried, and we didn't know where the child was for a while, and then we found out. She wrote a wrenching piece a week ago, and then this Sunday, part two of that two-part story or series was in the Tribune. And we asked Christy to come back because I think we need to know, and because she was so compelling last week. Christy, thanks for coming back into the studio. How are you?
Thanks, John.
You know, there I am ad-libbing a little of the details. What was the year that, what was the month that AJ was killed and found?
His father reported him missing. We have a missing child 911 call April 18th of this last spring.
April 18th. And then it was about, was it a week or 10 days between that time and when the body was found?
A six-day search. The community came together and searched for him. The FBI was involved, police departments from around Illinois and Wisconsin.
Were the parents always suspect?
They were. The bloodhounds never were able to get a trace on the boy outside of the home. So the police, the next morning, put out a statement saying, we're focusing on the home, which is code for we're focusing on the parents.
Father AJ himself is an attorney.
He is, and I think that's, you know, part of a protective factor, that why this couple was able to keep this boy despite all the hotline calls and police calls, that, you know, the father was a licensed attorney and the mom was a former licensed foster parent.
Both of them heroin addicts?
Correct. Long-time substance abuse users, opiates. Dad had an alcohol problem but seemed to get a hold of that. But yeah, cocaine and then heroin was the drug of choice for both that we could tell.
She had a child and her mother took custody of that child, right?
Right. And that was a private custody battle. Her mother had called DCFS's hotline and tried to get them involved circa 2012. And when nothing happened, she took her only daughter to court and was able to successfully petition for custody, and that child never went back with his mother.
That child is alive and relatively well today in college, correct?
He's 19. He's in college. He's doing well, and he was raised by his grandmother, and then there's two younger children, AJ's younger siblings.
That is, after AJ was born and they lost custody for a while, they got off the drugs but then got back on the drugs. She had two more kids, correct?
She did, including she just had this last daughter when she was in custody for AJ's murder.
There's so many interesting things about this story. Interesting is a stupid word, but I mean, it's a reminder of what abuse can be like, and it's not always from poor people or people who never had a chance. It tells you about the scourge of drug abuse and how people just let their lives fall to hell. And it also is a story about how DCFS, with the best intentions, sometimes can't get the job done.
Right. We documented also in a third story the 10 hotline calls that we were able to connect to this mother for before AJ was even born. And I have to say, you know, as dark as the story is, my humanity is a bit lifted as well, because the public, readers, subscribers, digital and old-fashioned print really seem to stay with the story until the end. And it's tough. It's very emotionally difficult.
What are the readers telling you?
There was a line in the story that the youngest child had said, mommy is a monster, and that seems to resonate with a lot of the readers. I tell a story about how she walked into a psych ward of a hospital and said, and she said, I want to, you know, walk in front of a bus. And a lot of readers are like, we wish she had. And many readers are angry and think that we should do more about the scourge of drugs. And many are angry with DCFS and tired of these headlines.
Well, and tired of, I think, the principle that says the DCF's job is to reunite families. That's job one for them, correct?
That's a national norm.
How do you feel about that? I'll tell you how I feel about that if you don't want to, but you go first.
You go first.
I don't like it. I think if the interest is in the child's well-being, then sure, use the parents as maybe the first stop. But I think this couple had blown their first few chances. And after that, I know it would be great for this couple if they were reunited with that child, for the couple. But I think a child doesn't kind of care who the parents are as long as they have parents and it's a happy life. if you had to err on one side, err on the side of the gamble of foster care or family members will raise the child, and not on the side of the parents getting custody and them redeeming their lives. That's my take.
There's a lot of talk about this very topic in Springfield, and I really think it's going to be interesting to see what lawmakers do with that. I mean, the interest is supposed to be on the best, what's best for the child, right? I do think that probably the hardest job there could be is to predict future human behavior. But in AJ's case, we found systemic failures, and then we saw individual worker errors where they weren't even following their own policies.
Let's talk about that in just a minute. It's 1:42 on WGN. Did you read Christy Gutkowski's piece in the Chicago Tribune on Sunday? The untold story of A.J. Friend's tragically short life, a time of hope, a violent death. And really, what are we even doing here if we haven't learned something from this story? So, Christy, pick it up there with us. Christy Gutkowski, the Chicago Tribune reporter's second part of her two-part series about A.J. Friend, a little boy who died earlier this year, evidently at the hands of his parents. They are in custody right now. I guess evidently is the right thing to say, right? They procedurally plead not guilty, but they have not been found guilty, correct?
Correct. It's pretty early, actually, in the legal process for the parents. They've both been indicted and arraigned and pled not guilty, and they're both in court. Both were just in court Friday, as a matter of fact, for monthly status updates where both sides are exchanging discovery. And there's been some headlines about a possible plea talks with the on the father's case, but the family says that they haven't been notified about that.
Just for the record, for the sake of our conversation here, how do we believe AJ died?
According to the coroner, and the McHenry County coroner refuses to release any documents regarding the autopsy, not even the basic autopsy report, which, I mean, we got it on Laquan McDonald, the biggest case in Chicago's recent history. You'd think we could get it on this one, but the Tribune is fighting for those records. But according to them, it was some sort of head injury from beating, physical.
Why did they do that?
Why
was he beat that day?
So they believe, according to the physical evidence, that he died 10 days before he was found. And he was found on the 24th of April. And according to statements from the father, he told authorities that AJ was put in a cold shower. He didn't admit to any beating, but he admitted to the time frame of April 15th, about 3 days before he called 911. So we believe he was beaten in the home, put into a cold shower for some reason, then put to bed cold and naked, and then the parents found him dead at some point.
Maybe as punishment for soiling his pants, they gave him a 20-minute cold shower.
Right. The father did tell authorities, according to the information we've recovered, that he wet his bed.
So that's the penalty then for that. The boy does not wake up the next morning. Well, if he said all of that, what's the purpose of a trial here? It sounds to me like he's admitted, the father has, to participating in his child's death.
It's interesting, in an affidavit was put out. So we don't know all of the prosecution's cards yet, but we have the access to this affidavit, which lays out a lot of the dad's statements. Andrew Friend is the one who led authorities to the shallow grave where he buried his namesake, his firstborn child, and a child that was named after him. And so we have statements that he said. We don't have all of them, and we don't know what the mother said, but we know that he admitted to certain things. He admitted to burying his child. He admitted that the child was punished for wetting himself, and he admitted the cold shower. But he didn't admit anything about the physical abuse.
The parents weren't on drugs. They were on drugs. Then when they wanted to gain custody of AJ back, they fairly cleaned themselves up for about a year, wasn't it?
They did. I mean, AJ's, this is one of the tragic things about this story, is that the system worked for a while in AJ's life. He was taken away at birth because of heroin pumping through his body, and he was kept in the loving home of a maternal cousin who had no other children and wanted to adopt him for 20 months. And then these parents had really, you know, the random drug screens and counseling had really gotten their acts together, and they get him back, and this court stays, DCFS, the private agency that's monitoring his care, they're still in his life until he's 2 and a half. And then in about April of 2016, all state monitoring ends because everyone's doing great, right? And then the family members later tell us that they were all cut off from AJ's life when he was about 3 and a half. So we figure 2017, 2018 is when things really, and that's when we start seeing more police activity and more hotline calls. We think that's when the parents fell apart again.
Yeah, we don't know what caused their relapse.
No, we know that they were on Suboxone for years, which, you know, controls, quells the cravings, and they were working their steps, their program, but we don't know. We know one interesting thing, that the couple had a lot of poverty issues, and they often would take in roommates in their basement, and one of them, a lot of times they would offer like a clean house or a sober house, and they took in this man who they had met through Rosecrans, through programs, and
Rosecrans is a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program.
Right, and that's the program that they had been involved
in. Which is a very well-regarded one, too.
Very much so. And relapse is expected many times, obviously. So this man enters the picture, and Joanne Cunningham begins a romantic relationship with him, perhaps unbeknownst to Andrew Friend, who owns the home. But we see, you know, there's this police report from Algonquin Police Department where Joanne and this man are fighting at a gas station, and someone calls 911. This is right before we know of her first relapse in 2018. And she's screaming at him, and the police come, and the police find out what's going on, and she says, I've been clean for 4 years. He's been clean for a year. He wants to go score heroin, and I'm trying to stop him. And he says, well, she's crazy. I just want to get away from her. And the very next day, she relapses for the first time. So there's really a documented history, and you can't blame it on this third man, this third person that entered the picture. But you wonder, you know.
Might have been the trigger.
Right.
You know, if this story had ended in a positive way, that is, for a year or more, they were, a couple of years, they were clean,
they
right?
They were, yeah.
So imagine this is a woman who's capable and competent, and her husband is an attorney, and he gets his license back to practice law, and they stay sober, and the boy comes home, and he's running around, and he's going to have a great life. And, I mean, the state should not be taking children away from parents just to make a talk show host happy. So if the story had finished that way, if projecting into the future, we would all feel differently about the state returning AJ to the parents. And when the state did that, like you said, it looked like a safe bet. Everybody was clean. There was still interaction with other family members, but you just can't know what's going to happen next. It's to me a reason why I still say, what a tragedy for the parents that the state took their kids away. Too bad. I have no sympathy.
Right. And but what's really sad is, like, because things worked well in our system initially, they really fell apart in the end. From 2018 on, there were police calls, hotline calls. There was enough warning signs. There really was. And it did not
right.
make
okay.
a difference.
So my scenario isn't even so true, because there were plenty of red flags. The state should have intervened
right.
again.
Right.
Why didn't they?
The Tribune found some systemic problems that we could talk about, and we found some individual worker error issues. One of the systemic things, and we've talked about this before, is these caseloads are too high. There is a federal consent decree that these investigators, and they're called child protection specialists, and they're the ones, after the hotline call comes in, say a teacher, a doctor, a police officer calls the DCFS hotline and says, you know, this needs to be checked out. DCFS sends this person to your door and knocks on the door. This person's, their job is critical to saving this child's life oftentimes and to intervening. And we find that the last two caseworkers or two investigators involved in AJ's life both had caseloads above what's allowed by a federal consent decree.
Are we doing anything about that?
Well, Governor Pritzker approved a state budget over the summer that was 11% increase for DCFS. So we're getting some new hires. You know, you got to start at, I believe, the front line, the front door, and it's the hotline. So they're supposedly hiring workers and increasing training. All of the people involved in AJ's case were veteran workers. These weren't new kids out of college who were easily tricked by, you know, a smooth-talking attorney.
Do you know what a caseworker earns in the system?
Well, these particular workers were all really well paid, and they get overtime. So, we're talking $90,000, $100,000 for the last investigator involved in AJ's case, but they are more well paid. They have a union than the private workers, the agencies that DCF has contracts with to stay with children in foster care and visit their homes once a month or twice a month. So I don't believe pay, is an issue.
I have just a few seconds left. Any last observations from you?
You know, we really tried to keep AJ's voice in the story out there so that people would remember him. There was such dysfunction with these parents. And I think that we were successful in showing who he was. He was bright and inquisitive. He loved to draw maps. And the parents claim he had ODD, but we found no evidence of that at all.
Right.
And, there really were no heroes except that little boy in this saga.
The story is headlined if you're reading it online, and we're getting lots of texts about this, and some of you are saying, thank you, Christy, for writing it, and somebody else said I had to toss the article aside, I didn't want to read it again. I know this isn't a pleasant conversation to listen to. We're done with it for now. The reporting and these kinds of stories are not done, but thank you for listening. Thank you for reading. I think we all need to sort of sometimes take this tough pill. It's headlined, The Untold Story of A.J. Friend's Tragically Short Life, A Time of Hope, A Violent Death. The Chicago Tribune, chicagotribune.com/investigations, or just Google that and you'll find Christy Gutowski's story. Nice to see you again, Christy.
Thanks, John.
Keep doing what you do.